Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by Dr. Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason, research fellow at Mercatus. He's also associated with Cato, and he does so many other things, including writing books such as The Myth of the Rational Voter, The Case Against Education, Selfish Reasons to Have Kids, and the topic of today's interview, Build Baby Build, the Science and Ethics of Housing Regulations. Welcome to the podcast.
Fantastic to be here.
Well, I'm going to ask you right up. Do you want to start with the science or do you want to start with the ethics?
Let's do the science.
Let's do the science. That's what I was thinking as well. So what has your research shown is wrong with our current system? I assume that you're addressing some type of problem. Mm-hmm. So what's going on?
Yeah, to be clear, most of what this book is doing is taking a lot of other people's research and putting it all together. I've done a little bit, but mostly I am a messenger and I'm trying to synthesize what's known and put it into a bite-sized package. So that's my role here. But here's what we know. We take a look and we see that housing prices in the United States and actually most other countries that you've heard of have gone up a lot. And the puzzle is, and a lot more than inflation in particular, it's not just inflation, they've gone up a lot more than inflation. And then the puzzle is why. There's a lot of stories that people have proposed, but the one that checks out is pretty simple. It just says that it's gotten really hard to go and build new homes because the government makes it very hard to get permission. They regulate whether you can build at all. They regulate the kind of stuff you can build. They regulate the density, which means that supply cannot respond to demand in the usual way. We've got data going back over 100 years, and we can see that in the past, it was common that housing prices would go up, which meant the prices were above the cost of production. But then the free market did the usual thing. Anytime prices are above the cost of production, let's build some more so that I can make money. And when you do that, prices go down. And in the past, what went up would go down. Demand would rise. Prices would go up. The supply would follow. And then they'd go back down. But over the last 50 years or so, this has generally greatly changed. And now prices overall just keep going up. There's occasional fluctuations, but after the Great Recession, there was a big dip. We've now totally recovered, and we are now at about 12% higher and adjusted for inflation than at the peak of 2006.
So what exactly is to blame amongst the many regulations? What are the top things a local or a state government could do to make this problem worse?
Right. So first of all, it's really hard to get permission to build tall buildings. Empire State Building was built in like a year. almost 100 years ago. The technology is totally solid. We know exactly how to do it. But getting the paperwork, on the other hand, that has gotten harder and harder and harder. San Francisco acted like they were being really chill by allowing like one skyscraper per year to be built. And even that may be going away. So that's one big problem. Because you may say, well, like you can't have everybody living in the most desirable area. Space is three-dimensional, so actually you can put an enormous number of people in a desirable area using existing technology. It's just the government won't let builders use it most of the time. Another big issue is multifamily housing. Most land in the U.S. is set aside only for single-family homes. So you could say, hey, a lot of people want to live here. Let's build some apartments. Let's build some townhomes. Very hard to get permission to build that kind of thing. Lots of extra hurdles, lots of extra waiting. But then even for single-family homes, it's very standard now to say there's a minimum lot size. You've got to use at least half an acre or an acre or 2 acres or 5 acres of land per house. This is not what builders want to do. If you just tell builders, do what you want, then normally in an expensive area, they'll put the houses like 10 feet apart. People want a little bit of land, but they're not willing to pay for an enormous yard when the land's expensive. And that means that, again, we just have this artificially scarce supply of housing, which means that it's expensive. And a lot of people just wind up saying, wow, it's really disappointing. Why me? Why is it that it's just so hard to afford to live in a nice place these days? And I said, the answer is really clear and not an ideological answer. I don't think of this as a left or right book. It's just a book where we look at actual research from people who looked at the world with an open mind. So yeah, the problem here is definitely government.
So if there's a bunch of problems, they're fairly clear, they're affecting most everybody. why is it that voters continue to put these types of regulators in power if it's really creating a problem? The problem is clear. It's expensive. There's an easy solution. Why does it seem so ubiquitous to have these types of regulators creating these types of regulations?
Yeah, great question. So the simple answer is all the regulations are basically popular because people are really terrified about what would happen if you didn't have the regulations. So, like, if anyone could build a skyscraper, you know, then this could lead to my light being blocked, and that would be terrible. If you could build multifamily housing, then again, there might be terrible traffic or parking. If you could go and have a whole lot of people build, you know, or build a whole lot of homes in a small area, then maybe our schools would be too crowded. So, you know, like, there's just a lot of complaints, some of which are true but exaggerated, and others I think are just wrong, or there's just a way cheaper way of handling the problem. I mean, the problems that people are most right about are allowing more construction means you're probably going to have worse parking and traffic. But there is a way cheaper way of handling this problem than strangling construction, and that is to go and just charge a price for driving during rush hour, charge a price for parking when there's a lot of people that want to park. And this way you can have more expensive driving and parking and way cheaper housing. I mean, right now people feel like, well, it's just so unfair to the poor to go and charge a quarter to drive. And it's like, you're charging them thousands of dollars to get an apartment in a nice area. Wouldn't it be better if that apartment was half the price and then you had to go and pay the money to pay the quarter to drive? And yet there are these weird taboos. It's just horrible and inhumane to charge someone for driving or parking. Whereas to strangle housing the point where it costs thousands of dollars to live in a closet, well, that's just life and you got to accept that. Most of what this book is saying is we shouldn't accept that. We just got a really crazy system. But again, it's not that the complaints are always wrong, although sometimes they are, but also like a lot of it is just half truth. So you ask people, what is bad about having more construction? And they can say, oh, well, there's more traffic and there's more crowding and the school, right? So it's like, okay, fine. You got a bunch of things that are true. But what about all the good things that happen when there's more construction? Like, what good things? More shopping opportunities, more job opportunities, more entertainment opportunities, more friends for your kids to play with. You know, if you allow denser housing, then your kids might be able to walk to their friend's house. Wouldn't that be great? And again, we have a pretty good idea about whether it's good or bad on balance to have construction because we see that people very gladly pay to live in really dense areas. And what are they paying for? They're paying to have all the good things of density plus all the bad things and the package they consider to be worth paying a lot for. So, you know, people often will say, well, this is just your weird preferences. Like, it's not just me. It's what people will spend their money on. Actions speak louder than words.
So that certainly works. Like, let's say pricing traffic in a pretty dense urban center. But what about places which are more suburban? I mean, that's having similar issues where people are opposing construction and new housing. What are the main issues which are in suburban? How do we deal with some of those?
Right. I say that suburban and urban areas used to be really different because you used to need a toll booth to collect money. Now with phones, you can do it anywhere. There's no reason there couldn't be charges for driving during any kind of street during peak times. And we've got a lot of evidence that it doesn't take a really high price to get people to go and vary their behavior and say, I guess I don't have to go shopping at 4 p.m. when it's inconveniencing a lot of other people who are already on the road. In terms of special issues with suburbia, I'd say that very few suburban areas would have skyscrapers if you legalized it. That's not the reason why they don't have it. You want to have skyscrapers when land is really expensive and people really desperately want to live in a certain specific area. But for the other problems, things like, how about having multifamily housing? Well, suburbia can have multifamily housing and plenty of people would be happy to live there. And then especially for single family housing, just saying you need a ton of land, right? If you just go and look at a typical development these days, the builder is forced by the government to go and give everybody a pile of land, which most people barely appreciate. Again, it's not like land isn't nice, but would you pay an extra $500,000 to go and get a full acre instead of a quarter acre? Few people would, but most people wouldn't. The reason why homes are so spread out is because government says they have to be spread out if you're going to get permission to build at all. And if you don't like it, well, fine, I won't let you build anything.
All of this is ringing true over here. I think I mentioned by email that I'm a builder. So
Nice. So thank you for your service. I only write about this stuff, but you have to actually deal with the government breathing down your neck and treating you like a criminal.
Oh, you know it. Yes. Yeah. So I've, you know, worked in a number of different localities, and they vary wildly about what they're particular on, what they're mm-hmm. not. And I can give you a laundry list of times where I've had to make choices, which I know hurt my profitability and hurt the consumer's enjoyment mm-hmm. of their would-be property mm-hmm. and only benefit the unique plans of whatever bureaucrat mm-hmm. happens to be seated in the great seat of zoning authority that year. But as far as measuring these costs, what do we know about the total cost of each of these? Have you gathered any data to kind of show the amount of economic impact some of these have?
Right. So there's a few different ways that researchers have tried to measure how much the total package of regulations raising prices. The most popular one just starts with saying, all right, well, let's go and look at the value of land where you don't have permission to build anything on it. And compare it to the value of land where you do have permission.
Beautiful. Yep.
All right. And it's like, and now, wow. Yeah. Turns out that land where you can't build anything on it barely costs anything. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas the same parcel of land with the paperwork attached saying, yes, you can go and build something here is worth a lot more. And in a nutshell, what researchers do is they just look at the price gap between the value of this land where you can't build anything on it versus the value of the land where you can build anything on it, and say that is the cost of the regulation. We don't know exactly which regulations. We're just measuring the total cost of all the paperwork, but it's a very reasonable approach to it. So, you know, like one thing you can do is just look at like how much is a vacant land where you can't go and build anything on it? What's that worth? And yeah, like that stuff's real cheap. I mean, I would say like, you know, this is kind of an underestimate because you might buy a vacant lot saying maybe one day I'll get the permission. Mm-hmm. I'll maybe my sister will marry the land use guy and everything will work out.
Hope springs eternal.
But still, it is a good way of getting a handle on it. I mean, you know, something else that people have looked at is just things like going to the official manual for construction costs and just saying, huh. So what's the actual physical cost of adding a 41st story onto an apartment building? And normally you find, yeah, it's not that much. So compared, you know, nothing compared to the actual market price. But then why is there this persistent gap? It's because it's so hard to get permission to build that tall apartment building. So that even though physically it's totally doable, but legally it's not doable. So, you know, like probably the best general way of thinking about all this research is they're trying to go and compare the cost of production given the laws with just the physical cost. And then that gap is the burden of government. You know, the amount of regulation varies very widely around the United States, but I still say that a good average estimate is that the overall price of housing would be about half of what it is.
Wow.
About half of what it is if anyone could build anything they wanted. It would fall a lot more than half in the most regulated places. So in San Francisco or New York City, it could easily fall by 80 or 90%, honestly. And again, it's just like, that's crazy. How could it be? Like, just imagine you could build 1,000 skyscrapers in San Francisco and just think about that. And like buy right. Yeah, so since you're a builder, you know about buy right construction, right?
Nope.
Oh, yeah, so buy right is the lightest kind of regulation where basically if you meet some basic standards, then the government must approve you.
Ah, okay. Yep.
So that's buy right construction. It's, you know, basically it's the best case scenario for a builder is I got land and I've got a buy right permit. So they cannot stop me.
Buy right.
They can't stop me.
B-U-Y.
B-Y space and then R-I-G-H-T. Gotcha. There's no, like in modern America, there's no such thing as buy right skyscraper construction. But if you imagine a world like that, where it's like, I own the land, I'm putting up a skyscraper, there's nothing you can do about it. And someone says, well, like you're blocking my light. It's like, you know what? We all block each other's light. So too bad. You can't do anything about that. That's the basic story. Anyway, like in these most regulated places, prices probably fall a lot more. But what's right, you know, so probably there'd be very little change in the most rural areas. Because if you're really rural, then almost no one's trying to stop you. It's when you're around other people that people get up in your business. Seeing there might still be some effects of things like what kind of Windows you have to use or whatever, but those are probably small compared to the other stuff.
So let me take the other side for a second and say, there's plenty of people who would hear what you just said and think, wow, that's amazing. I can buy a home for my family. I can live in a safer neighborhood. I can be housed in some newer housing stock, which is safer, more efficient, maybe more convenient. This just sounds wonderful. Yes, please do your thing. Cut it in half. But I'd imagine there's plenty of other people who think, whoa, I played by the rules. Mm-hmm. The majority of my net worth is in my house, as everybody told me I should do, and I followed it along. Hey, in the end of the day, over the long term, it rose what? On average, in most areas, say 5%. That's inflation plus covering all the cost of my maintenance and repairs. I'm not making a windfall here. Mm-hmm. I played by the rules. I'm making a return. I banked on this. Maybe I'm elderly. And I have a very expensive home because I've stayed put in an area which built up around me. That's catastrophic for me. I'd be underwater on, let's say, if you have a mortgage on this and then you have the value cut in half. For banks, what's going to happen to the banking sector when their collateral just falls through the floor? Because Dr. Brian Kaplan destroyed their balance sheets. What about the people who are going to be harmed by this? Is there anything we can do for them? Should we just tell them, hey, sorry, rules changed? What would you say to those guys?
Yeah, great questions. Really appreciate it. So there's the harsh answer, and then there's my real answer.
Oh, let's do the harsh answer first.
Yeah. The harsh answer is, do you know what happened to anyone who owned a taxi license after we allowed Uber?
Sure.
All right. So you did have a system where, again, if you have a piece of paper, you can go and make a pile of money going and doing taxi rides. And then some new company comes along and they basically wipe out the value of the taxi licenses. And there were a bunch of drivers who were planning on retiring based upon the $1 million+ value of their taxi license. Still one where you could say, the fact that we should feel really sorry for you because you invested in something where the supply is being strangled by the government and then we switch to a reasonable policy. But actually, I think I've got something much friendlier to say, which is that it is totally unclear that homeowners on balance are even benefiting from regulation. Why not? Well, here's the thing. Imagine right now that you own one of those lovely historic homes in San Francisco, costs millions of dollars. If people listen to me, do you know what you could do? You could sell that house to a developer for a pile of money, and they're going to buy up a bunch of other of those houses, and they're probably going to knock them down and build a skyscraper. So basically anyone who wants to go and sell out, they are suffering from existing laws. They really are. Anybody who wants to subdivide is suffering under existing laws. If you own an acre of land and you like to go and sell it to a developer who's going to put three more houses on it, and fine, I'll only have a quarter acre and we'll have three more houses and you will pay me for that land. You're losing out there. Here's something else that existing homeowners are losing. Their kids being able to afford to live within 100 miles of them. I mean, right now, if you're in San Francisco and you want your kid to live anywhere near you, it's like, I suppose I could take out a giant loan against my home equity and give it to my kid as a down payment so they can live near me. It's like, well, gee, it's not all that clear that on balance you're even gaining from this once you realize it. Now, I'm not claiming that every homeowner will benefit. I mean, in terms of banks, it's worth pointing out this is going to take a long time. So since these mortgages are probably the median mortgage now, like time left on it is probably more like 10 years. So, there's plenty of time for banks to adjust. It's something where it just takes a while to go, and build this much housing. I mean, I am talking about building a lot of housing. I mean, I think it'd be very reasonable to think that the construction sector could roughly double in size from like 10 million to like 20 million people. And then we'd probably spend a couple of decades building up because there's just so many opportunities to go and add more housing and just give people bigger, spacious, comfortable homes, which right now they're just priced out. But we got the technology. I don't know if you remember the $6 million man from the 70s. This was my favorite show when I was a kid. And the voiceover narration at the beginning is, we have the technology. And we got the technology to go and build very large, cheap homes if people can get the piece of paper from the government that says they're allowed to do what they know how to do.
So another cost, which I don't think is talked about near as much, is when we're all competing for a restricted housing stock, and it can't expand fast enough. So the supply is just not very elastic.
Right.
It's kind of like standing up in a stadium. You know, we subsidize something.
Yes.
We get more money. And now we're just, nobody's better off necessarily. Mm-hmm. But we've now sunk enormous amounts of capital in real estate. So what's the opportunity cost of doing that? Mm-hmm. And what do you think we could have as far as returns economy-wide if we did your plan, if housing dropped to half of what it is today and some of that capital can flow to other better value uses?
I mean, honestly, like if people listen to me, the capital is going to be flowing into housing, not out, because we're going to be building an enormous amount of housing.
Okay. All right.
I'm talking about like initially doubling employment in the construction sector. That's going to take a lot of investment to build that stuff. It's just going to be new stuff that doesn't exist right now. So it's going to be a huge boom sector where, it's like a lot of other cases where you start off with a thing barely exists and then it opens up and then investment pours in. You might remember there's this classic line from the CEO of IBM in the 50s saying, I think there's market for about 5 computers in America. All right. And then people figure out ways of going and making computers much more cheaply. And then it turns out that the sector greatly expands. It winds up getting a lot more capital, not less. So there's that. Now, what you're talking about, the bigger point is the main way that government tries to solve housing problems is by subsidizing demand, which is not a solution at all. If all you do is say, we're going to give you some money to buy housing, and also we're not going to allow more housing, this is all it does is raise prices. It doesn't like that's it, right? This is the idiocy of the system. It's actually pretty similar to what we do in medicine as well, as we just try to make sure everyone has all the money they need to go and buy medical care without doing anything to ensure to allow supply.
It's so, a certificate of need law.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like subsidized demand, constrained supply. That is a recipe for what we see in front of us, which is extremely expensive stuff. And like the sensible thing is to say the problem isn't that people don't have the money. The problem is that we can produce way more stuff at a way lower price if government just gets out of the way.
Amen. Yeah. So let's talk about government getting out of the way. A lot of people point to, say, Houston, saying, hey, they don't have zoning. They don't have much zoning. But others counter that, that's true, but the vast majority of the homes there are actually built inside of HOA communities. Mm-hmm. So what's the effect of HOAs? Are they just a private, more voluntary way of these would have been voters, but now consumers ganging up to restrict supply? What's going on there? And should we prefer HOAs to government? Where's your head on that one?
I mean, HOAs are a lot better than government in a lot of ways. The main one is they can't make you join one unless they start off owning the land. So if you start off owning your land, then HOA cannot make you join. So there's always alternatives to the HOA. Main thing with government is they can make everybody do it, whether they like it or not. Also with HOAs, you've got a lot of competing ones. So if there's one where you don't like how strict the rules are, you can go and do something else. Normally HOAs only kick in after the developer is done building anyway, which means that a lot of the very worst kinds of regulations, like saying that you have to have an acre of land for every house, just don't matter, because the builder, if they're allowed, they'll go and, with certain exceptions, normally squeeze in a lot of houses and a smaller amount of land, because that's what market demand wants. And then afterwards, you'll go and announce an HOA, and then they can go and tell you what color your drapes can be. But it's not that bad. You've got options, including the option of just not being an HOA. There's always plenty of legacy homes that were not in one. And if you have some weird views, like I really want to have weird colors, then you go and do that. So I think that goes into basically HOAs. They solve a lot of the problems that government's talking about, but in a much more pragmatic way, where they say, look, there's costs and benefits, and not everybody cares about something. So let people who care be in this HOA, and people don't care very much or not. I'm in an HOA, but mine is one of the cheapest HOAs I've ever heard of. So I think our fee is like $180 a year.
Wow.
Yeah. And all they do is mow some common lawn, do a little bit of landscaping. If a fence falls down, they fix it, and that's all they do. And so that's one where overall, like, all right, fine. I know there's other people who have really expensive ones which do a lot more, And again, the nice thing about markets is that they give you a range of options. And if you want it that badly, you can pay for it.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think that we're by default purchasing a vast amount of regulations that we're paying the cost of these. And I think if we just listed them kind of as a menu and said, all right, they're all gone. We took them all away. Which one would you like to buy back?
Yes.
And showed people that menu of them. I don't think they would buy any of them back. Maybe don't put like some type of crazy chemical company next to their preschool. Yeah. I don't know. That's about it. I think if most people had to opt into a regulation like an HOA versus having to opt out by moving out of their preferred city, things would be pretty different.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the main things that I talk about in the book is just that most of the public just refuses to believe that government regulation even raises prices. So yeah, like there was one where basically it's like, so if government made it legal to go and build a lot more housing, what would be the effect on prices? And about a third said prices go down, a third said they'd stay the same, a third said they'd go up. I mean, this is one where it's just very, like, people are just very resistant to the idea that allowing more building will reduce prices. And again, probably on the model of, look, why would builders be nice enough to cut price just because they are allowed to build more stuff? It's like, that's not what the textbook is saying. It's not saying that you cut prices to be nice. It's saying you cut prices because if you don't cut prices, you won't be able to sell your product. That's how competition works. And yet most people just refuse to accept it. And especially for housing, the same study showed that people believe it for used cars. So basically during COVID, when there was disruption of new car production and used car prices went up, general public overall, not 100%, but still like fairly willing to say, all right, I understand the reason why used cars are so expensive is because the supply of new cars was cut off, which then people shift over to used cars, raises the price. But you say the same thing for housing. It's like, no, you're in the pocket of the developers. You're just trying to trick us. There's a really cool paper that my friend Michael Manville at UCLA wrote where he just asked people, would you approve the following project? And the key part of the study is half the people were just asked the question. The other half were told if the developer would make a lot of money off of it. And just telling people the developer is going to make a lot of money without any other details leads support for approving the project to crash.
Wow.
Yeah, there's just a lot of resentment of the people that provide the second most essential good. Right. Wow. I mean, it's as if people hated farmers. And so there's dirty farmers just trying to go and make a buck off of my hunger. Right? Like, thank goodness that at least people do not hate farmers. But the level of antipathy for home builders is, to my mind, it's just odd. It's like, why them? Why are you mad at them? It's like, what do you think developers are? They're people who go and figure out a way to go and produce some housing that doesn't currently exist. Why are you against these people? Why do you hate them? Why do you demonize them for doing something that is obviously essential to having even not only a civilized life, to having like anything other than the most primitive life in a tent? It's thanks to developers that these houses exist.
Yeah. Yeah. You're making me lose faith in humanity even faster than my current trajectory.
This book is going to turn it all around.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I need. So a lot of these people have identified a supposed reason for the run-up in prices, and that is, I don't know, groups like BlackRock are coming in and they're buying up single-family housing. We have greedy landlords. I was a landlord for a while. I sold those off, but I can assure you I was foaming at the mouth greedy the entire time. And greedy landlords, greedy BlackRock and private equity and who knows who have come in and gobbled up a lot of the housing stock. And it's a demand side thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the increase in demand from these guys run it up. The little guy can't get a house. Is that an effect? If so, how much? Yeah. In all markets, some markets?
Yeah, this stuff is really crazy. I mean, like, there's a basic economics of middlemen in general. Right? Like, imagine that all the grocery stores shut down. How would you get your food? Well, you could drive out to the countryside, stop by every single farm, ask them what they're selling, and go and make your purchases. And after you spent your whole weekend, you'll have a basket of groceries. Or we can do what we currently do. which is to have a grocery store. It's a business that goes and first deals with the farmers so you don't have to, and then makes it conveniently available. That's what's going on with all these other middlemen. Is there's the current owner, there's you, and there's someone there in the middle. And what are they doing? Like they are making it easier. They are doing things like buying things up and improving them, or consolidating, or they're knocking things over and building new ones. So like the idea that the middlemen are to blame for high housing prices really just makes very little sense. They are a vital part of the market, as vital as grocery stores. And the story that is not wrong is just to say, well, like if a bunch of tourists come in and rent houses, and that raises prices. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's true. If your area is really popular with tourists, that does raise demand. It does make things more expensive. But there's a really simple way of going and handling this in a wonderful and amicable and win-win way, which is, how about you make it possible to build stuff so then we can build a lot of stuff for tourists and locals can also go and live there? That would make a lot more sense. Look, if your area is a wonderful tourist location, that is something you should capitalize on by letting the industry get really big so they can build a ton of stuff for tourists. And then at the same time, it's, you know, if it is cheap to go and build, easy to get permission, they'll also happily go and build stuff for all the people that are the locals. That'll happen too. So that's what I would say is the reasonable approach, is to look at tourists as an opportunity, not as some horrible burden on the locals. The system we have, like in a way, it does make it bad for at least some locals, because you are competing with them. But given that we got the technology just to build vastly more housing in the same area, it is not a constructive approach to try to keep them out. The constructive thing is to say, hold on, why don't we go and build a better world here? Let's build a ton of stuff for everybody. It can be done.
You're speaking my language here. So let's say we go ahead and do this. Of course, we're going to have lower regulations are going to lead to a higher housing stock, and that's going to, increase supply. The price will fall, and that's wonderful. But what are some knock-on effects? What happens next to family formation, to crime, to a lot of those things? Do we get any other positive effects from bringing down this cost?
Right. Chapter 3 of this book is called the Panacea Policy. Panacea, it's a word that means a cure-all. It's from the Greek goddess Panacea, the goddess of universal remedy. Now, anytime someone tries to sell you a panacea, normally you should just say, yeah, you're crazy, you're a crackpot, you're trying to steal my money. I don't actually claim that housing deregulation will solve all problems or anything like that. But it is amazing how many specific, seemingly unrelated problems housing deregulation will make a big dent in. The obvious ones that you mentioned. So we got fertility. Well, right now there's a lot of people who live with their parents because they can't afford to get their own house. It's not the only reason they're not having kids, but as long as you cannot afford to leave your parents' basement, you're probably not going to get married and you're probably not going to have any kids. Make housing a lot cheaper and people are going to be a lot more open to family formation and having kids at an earlier age. That's pretty obvious. And in the book, I go and cite the papers that are around on this, which do fit with common sense. Let people affordably leave their parents' basement, get their own place, and then some people that would not have had kids or would have delayed will get going. The crime one is pretty interesting. You might think there's not any connection, but there was a very cool experiment where they started by saying a lot of American cities is actually vacant land. So I think their number was 15% of urban land in the U.S. is vacant.
Wow.
And it's like, right. And then, and then just taking a look, oftentimes local criminals use the vacant lot for conducting crime. Right. This is where the gang hangs out, in the vacant lot. You don't hang out in the Walmart. You hang out in the vacant lot next to the Walmart.
Sure.
Right. So the experimenters had an idea, kind of seems like these vacant lots might be causing crime. Maybe it's just coincidence. But anyway, what they did is they got the city of Philadelphia to go along with a really big experiment to randomly landscape half the vacant lots in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, just like with a new pharmaceutical, you randomly give it to half of people and you see whether the people that got the drug did better. Similarly here, they randomly went and landscaped and beautified half the lots to see what effect this would have on crime. And it worked. So they found that police recorded crime fell by some modest amount, like 7%. Perceived crime fell by a lot more, like 30%. And basically, once you turn these vacant lots into a nice little park, then instead of it being a place for criminals to go and cause trouble, becomes a place for local families to go and hang out. Now, the authors of this piece actually had a couple of paragraphs saying, now don't think that we're in favor of developing anything. This isn't about gentrification. We're not horrible gentrifiers. We just want to go and put trees and grass and place that on a vacant lot. We're not evil. And I'm reading this thing and saying, look, if just turning a vacant lot into a park can go and reduce crime, it seems like putting a whole building there would do a lot more to reduce crime. Yeah, and like, why not? Why is it that you have to run away from the idea of turning, of building things on vacant lots? It is just common sense to say, look, it's a vacant lot in a valuable area. There's better things that we can do with it. How about we let people go and build a skyscraper so 5,000 people can have a home?
Definitely. It's kind of interesting that that worked so well. People don't want to smoke their crack pipe next to a daffodil.
It's probably more complicated. Like the nice setting brings in families. The families, the criminals are like, I don't know. I don't want to.
This is weird.
It's one thing to try to intimidate another criminal gang, but another thing to go and threaten a mom if she calls the cops on you. That's going to look bad. So, and like, you know, the cops are a lot more likely to come down on you like a ton of bricks if you threaten a mother versus if you threaten another criminal. So, that's sort of the idea of an experiment, is capturing all the direct and indirect effects of the policy. Some of the other things I talk about in the book are just reducing inequality. And, you know, this is an issue that people keep complaining about, isn't so terrible, how unequal our society is. And it's like, well, let's see. Who spends a larger fraction of their income on housing, rich or poor? Yeah, it's poor people spend more money on housing. Who's poorer, tenants or landowners or homeowners? Yeah, tenants. So yeah, if we were to go and deregulate and reduce the price of housing, this is good for people in general on average, but it's especially good for the poor. There is a really cool paper where the author, Matt Ronley, he started with all these numbers about how capital share is rising. And then he said, well, what's even in this measure of capital? Is it just business people? Is it just investors, just bondholders? He said, no. Actually, homes are in this measure of capital. He said, huh, that's interesting. He said, what if we went and broke it down by type? And what he found is over a lot of countries, actually, the only reason why capital share is rising is just because the size of the market value of real estate is rising. So it's really the rising share of income going to capital is much more about just people in San Francisco who bought a house 50 years ago and then saw its value rise by a factor of five. It's not nearly as much about just rich people investing well or business or anything else. That stuff is actually really stable. So it's one where you just get a totally different diagnosis of the problem. The usual one is all these greedy rich people and businesses are just grabbing a bigger and bigger share of the pie. It's like, no, it's rather government has strangled competition in one important sector, and that sector is the one that is absorbing a really large share of production without the benefit of entrepreneurship and savings that you get out of regular investment.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. I mean, yeah, that's kind of what we were kind of getting at is that earlier question about, is it crowding out other stuff? It sounds like it is crowding things out.
Well, you can say that it's a way for people to make a lot of money without really doing anything.
Yeah.
Right. And it's one thing to make a lot of money doing something awesome. It's another thing to make a lot of money just sitting there. Right? Mm-hmm. And like the people in San Francisco bought their homes 50 years ago. What did they do that was so great? They just bought a home and then and like, oh, wow. The government here strangled construction, and then the tech sector exploded, and they wound up getting a giant share of the benefits, which they didn't do anything about. In a free market, then they would have gotten some piece of that pie because developers would have bought them out, but it would have been much more modest, and most of the gains would have just gone to the enormous population that would have said, "Hey, I want to be where the gold rush is."
So I want to run a few things past you. Cool. How's that sound? All right.
Yeah. Okay.
I've thought about how exactly to sell, because I'm 100% on board with this. I mean, let's just pile all the regulations in one big pile and light it on fire.
all right. You're my man.
Definitely. And we're not even going to zone it for public burning. Yeah. We're just going to do it. but how do we sell this to people? Mm-hmm. And, I think it is tricky. You know, people clearly are concerned about these things. So what I've considered is some type of, waiver system.
Mm-hmm.
So we say, you know, I'll give you a real example. I was putting a house on a piece of property that I have actually two houses on a piece of property. And initially I begin and I had one plan, but the city arrives and says, we forgot, we told you the wrong building offsets. You're going to have to push it about 15 feet farther from the road into a very steep wooded bank. And I thought,
I don't envy you this job. Yes, that sounds so aggravating.
So I thought, oh my word. All right. Well, now I have to scrap my plans. So I quick drew up new plans and I was going to do a one story because that fit the area. Mm. There's a lot of elderly people. But now I have to do a two story because I need a smaller footprint. And in the end, who won? Nobody. Just the regulator who thought that was a good offset. What if I could say, all right, I hear that this standard is, say, a 35-foot offset, but I would like to purchase a waiver from the city government, and maybe there would be a list of prices. We could discuss how exactly we would generate those prices. And the revenue could say, I don't know, reduce taxes for the current homeowners, or it could go to the schools, or maybe do some type of public event, or do some benefit to the existing people. So now the existing people living in the town think, boy, you know what I really hope the developers do? I hope they come to our town and break every single rule and get a waiver and are able to put whatever they believe is just most valuable to the consumer on this land, because, well, that's going to be great for us because we actually get a windfall here. What do you think about some type of waiver like that?
It's a great idea, but I don't think it will sell because normal people will just say, oh, some rich developer thinks they can just go and toss us some money and do whatever they want. I mean, like, in terms of, like, what do people who oppose development actually think like? There's this very cool book called Neighborhood Defenders, where they actually got the transcripts of most of the land use meetings in the whole state of Massachusetts.
Oh, I've got to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. And again, like what they found is, like, most of the complaints are not about I need to protect my property values or I want money. The complaints are usually about things like birds. There's a bird nest here, and I'm willing to destroy a $50 million project over a bird nest. And like you say, well, anything we could do, and like, oh, well, let's have another 1 year study. So yeah, I think it would be great if you could, if there was just a mandatory transparent price list. I mean, like, my dream would be one where it's like, this is what you have to pay for a skyscraper, and they just write a check. Okay, I'm building it now. Like, that would be great. But I don't think that's actually going to win people over because again, there's such a resentment of people that are making money off of things and such a resentment of the idea that you can buy your way out of a rule. I mean, I could be wrong, and I hope I am wrong. I mean, I think the stuff that probably is going to be more effective, there's some of it is like the state level preemption saying that you're not allowed, local governments aren't allowed to have single family zoning, which has been happening in some places. Usually there's some additional rules that sort of dilute the value of that, but still that's a move in the right direction. Things like what DeSantis is doing in Florida, where he just says, look, local governments have a certain amount of time to respond. And if they don't respond to your application in time, it's a yes.
Nice.
Yeah, that's one where it sounds like it's a lot more appealing to what I call a psychologically normal human. It's not one where rich people are able to go and pay their way out. It's just where bureaucrats have to get off their butts and go and do the paperwork. And if they don't, there's the consequence of they don't actually have, they lose their chance to say anything about it anymore. So there's that. I mean, honestly, like, a lot of what I'm trying to do with this book is to change people's minds. I know it's tough, but I mean, there's a few things that I'm doing in this book just to be more effective than other people. This isn't the first book that has said things like this, but so one thing, there's a whole lot of really intellectually solid research that is super boring to read. So what I try to do in this book is a nonfiction graphic novel. It's a comic book, really. It's based, so it all very heavily based on the research, but I think that, you know, by combining words and pictures, it's just a lot more entertaining than a regular paper. If you want to know the actual intellectual justification, you can go and read the endnotes. But if you just want to go and have a fun journey through this issue, that's what the book does. So, like, you know, think about it as like a illustrated documentary where I just walk through the research, but it's very conversational. It's also one where I just try to use a lot of humor. It's very hard to have a conversation with someone who's angry. They may want to talk, but they definitely don't want to listen. You know, much of what I'm trying to do in this book is just to get people laughing, to put a smile on their face so that we can have an actual conversation about, does it really make sense to stop a skyscraper over a bird?
Right. That's awesome. So we kind of kicked it off with the, you know, your book has the, you know, it's the science and the ethics. So if you want to pivot a little bit to the ethics,
right,
in kind of our last 15 minutes or so, tell us a little bit about that. How do you appeal to the ethical concerns? Because when we're trying to persuade people, the idea that our GDP might bump a little bit, or that developers will be better off, or even that other people will be better off, can be a little bit hazy. It just doesn't really persuade. Yeah. But if you can kind of pull on somebody's, you know, this is wrong. This is right. It's as wrong to write these regulations as it is to kill that little adorable baby bird. what's your tax? How exactly do you go about that?
Right. So a lot of what I do there is just say, look, I could go and tell you, here's my ethical philosophy, and this policy follows from my ethical philosophy, and that would convince about three people. So instead, what I want to do is say, look, here's a whole bunch of very popular political philosophies. I'm not even going to try to argue for or against them. I'm just going to say, like, for each of them, let's just imagine they're right, and then ask, what should each philosophy say about what the best housing policy is? And that's where my whole thesis is. Almost any ethical theory that you've heard of will be on board with this for different reasons. I mean, probably so. Like, one thing I say is, look, it makes total sense for a very left-wing person to favor housing deregulation because it's really good for the poor. It's going to go and reduce inequality, raises social mobility. But it also makes total sense for someone who's very conservative to favor it because it's removing a bunch of ridiculous government regulations, and it's making family formation cheaper, and it's reducing crime, right? And also, I point out, really good for working class males. Like in the last 8 years, the Republican Party has gotten really big on, we got to do something for all of the workers who lost their industrial jobs. They basically haven't done much of anything for them because it's just a declining sector, because we've gotten so good at having one worker build a ton of televisions. It's never going to be one that employs a lot of people again. On the other hand, construction is one where it employs 10 million people, large majority working class males, non-college males, and there is a ton of additional demand because almost everybody, if the price was right, would want a bigger home. And so this is one where I say this is a realistic solution to what can we do for non-college males who really have been struggling with the modern economy. They don't want to become programmers. They don't want to go and work in the service sector. They want traditional manly employment. Construction's a perfect fit. Steelworker is just never going to be a job that employs a lot of people again, but we could easily go and take this sector that employs about 10 million people right now and through deregulation turn it into one that employs 20 million people, most of them non-college males. These are high paid jobs. So it is a great practical solution to this problem. I have a piece where I say, revive construction, not the Rust Belt. Right, the Rust Belt is kind of a lost cause, but construction, same basic demographic, same kind of person that would want those jobs, but these are products that the world really wants, whereas most people do not want to get three more televisions.
Yeah, you know, for my more liberal friends, I point out that just look into the history of zoning. Why this is, we found it. This is structural racism, guys. That's how it began. We got to get rid of this. And indeed, it does hurt minorities and poor and everybody else. I mean, come on. And luckily, I actually think that the left is getting on board with this a little bit. I think that we're actually picking up a little bit of steam.
So here's what I think was going on. So there is the group of YIMBY activists who definitely lean left, and they're the most vocal proponents of deregulation, especially in major urban centers, which tend to be very liberal. But basically, they're starting in a desperate circumstance, and they're making it a bit better. Right. On the other hand, the areas where it's actually easy to build stuff are your deep red states, especially outside of the major cities. So get 30 minutes outside of any major city in Texas, and then you are likely to see enormous developments happening. These are areas where I don't think they've got some big ideological commitment to building. It's just that it's always been that way, and it's going to stay that way. So that those are what I see are like the two areas where the most is happening. On the one hand, you've got left-wing NBA activists who do not speak for the left generally. They are their own special breed of left-wing activist. I hope that their influence keeps spreading. And on the other hand, you've got places that are where regulation is light more by default than by principle. Mm-hmm. In a way, I'm hoping to simultaneously boost both groups and get Yimbys to really say, look, here is a book that shows how awesome what we're doing is, and you can read it in 2 hours, and it's really fun to read. And on the other hand, could go into places where they just haven't really thought about why not have a lot of regulation and make them say, you know, this thing that we've been doing, not thinking about it, we made the right choice without thinking about it, and now we're really glad, and like we are the model of the country. You know, I'd say that even areas where Yimbys have had the most success, they still look really bad compared to 30 minutes outside of almost any city in Texas.
Right, right. So what do you think is the easiest, just low-hanging fruit as far as changes that we can make? I mean, just to give an example, I don't know too many people, even those ornithology enthusiasts that you mentioned earlier, who would oppose allowing for duplexes in mm-hmm. single-family homes. That one, I'd imagine if we polled people, it'd be pretty popular. I mean, not that many people.
Maybe you know different people than me. Like I like almost everybody that is in my neighborhood, other than my closest friends. If you said duplexes, I think they would flip their lids.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. And I think they would be much less hostile to putting a second single family home on the same lot. The duplex, they'd be like, duplexes, yuck.
Well, let's put it this way: as opposed to single family. Or as opposed to multifamily houses yes. in a single family
right.
zone.
But you know, is the most single family areas, like they already have what they want. So mm-hmm. you'd be able to bargain them up to something else. That's, again, I think probably some of the low hanging fruit is like for a new development, how about they can have less land per house?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's one nice. Where it's like, it doesn't, you know, like it's like pretty far away from you. What's the big deal? Why can't you just allow them to do that? I think that one is probably not so bad. I mean, some of the really low-hanging stuff is just tightening up historic building regulation. In New York City, has historic parking lots.
Historic parking
lots. Historic parking lots. Yesterday, okay. I can't remember, someone was telling me there's historic vacant lots. I was like, what?
Like, I've never heard this before. Historic vacant lot. Like,
it's historically been vacant. It's a symbol of everything our country holds dear. A piece of land that you can't build anything on. So... that's the kind of stuff that I would think, you know, so like green lighting construction on vacant lots is, I think, also one where you say, look, you know, it's a den of crime. Like it's like, wouldn't it be a lot better just let them build something on it than to go and have gangs operating there? I think that one's probably not too bad in terms of how saleable it is. So I think those are the main places that I would start.
Perfect. You know, there's a couple podcast back, I did an episode on building zoning land use regulations, and I looked into, there was a survey done on 3,800 different home builders across the nation, mm-hmm. gathered a bunch of awesome data, and we looked at the average fixed cost, which came from regulatory costs mm-hmm. and also the land mm-hmm. that they were purchasing. And if we just take that first suggestion that you made, which we take away the lot size, mm-hmm.
yeah.
Minimum lot sizes, if we could say put two houses
yeah.
in most places and we cut the fixed cost of land being the largest fixed cost.
Yeah.
Then, as I kind of explained in that earlier podcast, is the math is quite simple. That allows for the possibility of a smaller house, because if you can mm-hmm. say build for $150 a square foot and you're selling for $200, you have a $50 spread. Well, that means if your land is $50,000, the smallest house you can possibly build breaking even is 1,000 square feet mm-hmm. and insert whatever mm-hmm. numbers you like. Mm-hmm. So people are complaining particularly about there being no starter homes. Mm-hmm. To me, it's like, well, yeah, we should change marginal costs by, you know, sure. ditching some useless regulations here and there, maybe providing for some type of exceptions, waivers, whatever. But really, it's slashing those fixed costs can actually allow for things mm-hmm. which are smaller. Whereas right now, I think the break even, if you take that survey, was somewhere around, it was over 2,000 square feet.
Oh, yeah. Now that makes total sense. Sure.
Well, let's see. So I like that you kind of make a case from like the liberal, from the conservative, maybe the libertarian perspective, Do you want to wrap up with just kind of your final case, if you to sum up the science, sum up the ethics, and try to speak to those little bird enthusiasts and give them your final pitch, push them over the edge. Maybe they'll join our bonfire and getting rid of all these regulations.
So what I say in the book is that it's very easy just to make a list of problems, but the fact that you've got a lot of items on your list doesn't actually show that they're a really big deal. There's a page in the book where I've got a bear going and debating a mouse, and the bear just screams $1 trillion in savings, and the mouse just goes and lists a bunch of tiny problems. And he says, you know, like, so like urban pig farms, how do you know that won't happen? I mean, I've done a bunch of public debates, and I've noticed that usually the winner is just whoever has the largest number of arguments. And each one could be pretty tiny, but just by virtue of overpowering someone with a sheer list of the arguments, it's very convincing. So I'd say that, like, honestly, you know, if you just calm down and say, look, we need to consider, like what are all of the good things that are coming out of allowing something? And again, like, honestly, like, when, like, a reasonable estimate is trillions of dollars. So you could even go and look at a lot of the complaints and say, look, they're not totally wrong. But to go and say, yeah, but are they trillions of dollars bad? And it's just, they're not. So if you just go and calm down and put numbers on it. Now, I know most people don't like doing that, which is why, in a way, it's so hard to make the case. Probably the other thing I like to say is people, when they look at construction, they only think about the bad things that might happen. They don't think much at all about the good things. And so someone's going and building new houses, like, well, this could lead to crowding in the schools. Or maybe a new kid will move in who will be your kid's best friend, and you'll have a little kid that's within walking distance, and you won't need to go and drive your kid to their play dates anymore. Wouldn't that be really great? So say that, like, at minimum, you want to go and consider all the good things and all the bad things and just balance them out. But we actually can look at the world and see that most people already have done this balancing. And when we look at people's actual behavior, we see that most people consider construction actually to be on balance a good thing. How do we know? Well, just take a look at how much money people spend to live in New York City. They spend a huge premium in order to go and endure terrible traffic and crowding and noise. So, like, why do they do it? Because there's also a bunch of awesome things about New York City, like there's endless entertainment options. You're close to a lot of different possible friends. There's better job options. And when you look at that whole package, people very gladly pay a large premium to get the package of all the good things that come with construction and all the bad things, which shows that on balance, it's a good thing. And instead of trying to go and treat developers like criminals, we should go and give them a big thumbs up and a smile. And honestly, that's a lot of what I'm trying to do in this book. Say, thank you, people that put roofs over our heads. I couldn't do it myself.
Oh, sure you could. Yeah, you spend one afternoon interning at Busher Enterprises LLC, and you'll be putting roofs over people's heads in no time. If you can write a comic book, you can roof a house. Everybody knows that. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. I encourage everybody to pick up a copy of that book, or really any of Dr. Kaplan's book. It was a pleasure talking with you. I'm glad you are fighting the good fight for greedy developers and home builders like me. In addition to our giant piles of gold coins that we swim through, we also like to know that the thoughts and prayers of academics like you are floating out in the ether to change people's minds.
Well, I really hope so. And anyone who's listening and wants to buy the book, it's right on Amazon. And I think they've cut the price a bit, so it's like $24 now. But here's the good news. Just like subdividing a lot in a bunch of houses, this book, by virtue of being a comic book, people and families fight over it. So your kids may want to read it. People that normally would say, I'm not going to read a book, it's too boring. I mean, my five-year-old was looking over my shoulder when I wrote my first graphic novel, and that's where I'm like, I may be onto something here. So buy it, and it's fun for the whole family.
There you go. And hey, just like housing, if many people are fighting for a limited supply, the answer is clearly to expand supply and buy more of the book.
That's right. Yeah. Feel free to buy multiple copies. That's cool too.
And the link will be in the show notes.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Great to talk to you. Bye.
All right. Very fun.